And since the whole of this sphere is populated only by beings of the same wavelength range, which means, beings that are likewise freed from dark and dismal kinds of thought, existence here is thus a life among loving friends in light and joy. And the being therefore experiences here a world where its dream is reality, paradise or the sunny regions and home of life. Chapter 39 The Artist's Paradise. We will here provide a few examples of what it means when, without any outrades or tools, matter automatically takes form in accordance with the mental concentration, wish and will of the living being, as it does on the spiritual plane of existence. By virtue of this divine state, an architect can build as many country residences or other large-scale buildings as he wants. Here he is not burdened by having to earn a living by means of his artistic training and talents. There are no means of earning a living here. No one on the spiritual plane has to earn money or work in order to sustain his daily life. Here life is an absolute dream existence for everyone, and the beings manifest absolutely only what they themselves want to manifest. They can experience only those things in their surroundings and those manifestations of their fellow beings that will please and delight them. The sensory transformation they underwent in the epoch of purgatory prevents them from getting onto the same wavelength as anything that does not have this effect. For this reason, absolutely no darkness whatsoever can arise here. When an architect wants to create a building on the spiritual plane, he does not need to have a number of associates, craftsmen and laborers in order to carry out his plan, as is the case on the physical plane. He has likewise no problems of any kind with materials, since spiritual matter, which is in itself unmanifested and present everywhere but which, through the power of thought, materializes and takes form in accordance with the living being's wish and will, manifests itself here too. Thus the architect has in his power the ability to obtain sufficient material for his projects, if he at all wants to build them stone by stone and does not immediately imagine them completely finished without any preceding construction work, this being also in his power. Here he can thus create all the dream projects that may have been impossible for him to build on the physical plane because of many and various obstacles. Regarding other artists, they will likewise, by the mere power of thought, be able to create the most splendid landscapes, portraits, imaginary figures or works of art in many different directions. These works of art differ from works of art on the physical plane in that they appear to be alive, to the extent to which their originator has been able to imagine them and animate them with his own life. Here the most elevated and perfect artistic representation of a landscape will not take the form of a picture painted on canvas. It will, on the contrary, be in its natural state and extend for kilometers, with forests, lakes, fields, sky, sea and land, with towns, people, animals and so on, all according to the talents and the ability to concentrate his wishes and thoughts that the artist has acquired during his evolution through his physical terrestrial lives. While such a work of art on the physical plane would be only a relatively miniature picture painted on canvas or the like with immovable details, it is, however, on the spiritual plane a complete realization of the artist's dream, depending on how much he has developed towards the stage of genius. He can thus inject his own energy or life force into his work of art. Swans would swim on the lake. Lovely white summer clouds would float across the sky. The forest would ring with birdsong and other sounds that belong there. The summer breeze would rustle the treetops, and the waves of the ocean would roll softly in towards a lovely white beach where people would tumble in the blue-green swell. And over the entire scene the sun would cast its all-enlivening and warming heavenly light. The whole vision would be born and sustained completely by the artist's mental talents, concentration, wish and will. The artist can, of course, within the scope of his particular talents, his abilities to think and create on the spiritual plane, also imagine quite another motif. And as thinking here is the same as direct creation in matter, this work of art will emerge as a new radiant vision for himself and his admiring fellow beings on this plane. This work of art can be a representation of a storm. Black clouds penetrated by flashing lightning will then cover the sky. Rumbling thunder and the shouts, cries and other sounds that belong to such a situation are heard through the storm. With his mental concentration and talents, he can also create the most beautiful and most radiant landscapes in the fiery glow of sunrise and sunset, just as he can create silvery moonlit landscapes and other landscapes as radiant, living visions. If the same artistic genius's creations on the spiritual plane are figures of people and animals, they will likewise appear to be quite natural and alive. The figures of people can talk, sing, laugh and cry just as the animal figures can run, jump and draw in accordance with the artist's talents, wish and will. Chapter 40: The unfinished human being's dream existence or paradise. Even if one has not advanced as far in evolution as to have become a genius at being able to think artistically and produce spiritual works of art like those mentioned above, this does not prevent one being able to have one's dream existence in quite other fields. We have mentioned the above examples only in order to show how perfect ingenious works of art can be on the spiritual plane. Thus all human beings, from the first frail, primitive forms in evolution right up to the finished human being in God's image, experience the realization of their most beautiful dreams on the spiritual plane. This holds true for the primitive people of the primordial forest as well as for civilization's highly gifted people, researchers and scientists. Whether one is a religious believer or the opposite is totally immaterial, since this cannot prevent one from having a dream or longing to experience an ideal existence. One cannot possibly avoid experiencing this beyond physical death, since here matter automatically takes form in accordance with one's thought, wish and will. The pygmy thus experiences that his primitive dreams take the form or are along the lines of how he learnt to think on the physical plane. The same is true of the Indian, the Eskimo, the Fujian, indeed in brief, of individuals of any race whatsoever. They all experience precisely that which was their highest dream existence on the physical plane of existence, but which, because of insufficient development and perhaps other circumstances, they could not possibly experience on this plane. Thus the poor human being that perhaps starves, freezes and lives in rags on the physical plane experiences on the spiritual plane the realization of its dream, arising from its physical condition, of a contrasting existence where it has plenty of delicious food, good, warm clothes to wear, a beautiful house to live in and a plentiful supply of money. In the same way a skinflint or miser will receive oceans upon oceans of money on the spiritual plane in accordance with the unsatisfied longing for the fulfillment of the desire for money that he had on the physical plane, and in accordance with a dream that this longing gave rise to. On the spiritual plane too, anglers and hunters experience lovely countryside in which they can satisfy their desire. The angler thus experiences rivers with an abundance of beautiful fish, while the hunter experiences woods or terrains with lots of animals. Life on the spiritual plane is thus bliss for such beings. Likewise, there is no limit to how perfectly the vain person's dream can be realized on the spiritual plane. He will be dressed and adorned as he wishes, in purple robes, silk and gold with a great many medals and decorations. Indeed, in some cases he actually experiences being a prince, a pope, a king or an emperor and can be duly invested with an ermine robe, crown and scepter and sit on a golden throne and speak to his subjects. In other cases, the being appears on the spiritual plane in accordance with its dream or dream existence as a magnate, a Croesus, or a multimillionaire living in a huge castle or luxury palace with a large staff of servants, a luxury car, a yacht, and a racing stable. The dominant beings here are not, as a rule, those that were really wealthy on the physical plane. Most often their dreams go in other directions depending upon the level of satiation with the Croesus existence they have already reached on the physical plane. Similarly, we find here on the spiritual plane the home of all ingenious humor. Here humor is not written down or drawn as pictures on paper or canvas. Like the previously mentioned artist's works, it appears in a natural state in the way that its originator imagines it. Funny figures of people, animals, and things appear as living characters, and the comedies become real, plastic or stereoscopic experiences in color, sound, and movement to the extent that their originator is able to animate them with his or her thought, talent, wish, and will. From this sphere, the humor-packed products of artists in wit are transferred to the physical plane as amusing cartoon films. Since this form of art can reproduce the spiritual original on the physical plane in the fullness and freedom of movement of the living form, people can, even through cartoons, get an inkling of the freedom the spiritual creative ability has to let thought take form automatically and directly in spiritual matter without outer aids and in accordance with the being's wish and will. Thus, a creation that cannot possibly take place on the physical plane can flourish abundantly here. Chapter 41: The Living Being's Absolute True Paradise. As we have begun to see here, there is no human being whatsoever who will not experience his absolutely most beautiful dream coming true beyond death, except during its passage through purgatory, which, in only a very limited number of cases and in special situations, is dark and painful. Being afraid of death is therefore a terribly dark and disheartening derailment of the mentality, since beyond death lies hidden the realization of the being's particular dreams or dream existences, or an existence that has to be acknowledged as life's absolutely true paradise. Is there any other existence anywhere that can in this way be paradisiacal for people than one in which they are allowed to experience in advance the most beautiful ideals of their lives long before they have developed sufficiently to experience them in their purest form on the physical plane of existence? And how can any other form of life experience give greater happiness and well-being than the experience of having one's greatest normal longings come true in an experience of reality in its purest form, where one is freed from any illnesses, sorrows, worries, economic troubles, or other people's hatred and bitterness, antipathy and slander? Can any other form of life experience be more pleasing and delightful? And can the being wish for a higher and better form of life experience than having his greatest wishes come true? We have thus here arrived at life's only absolutely true paradise. Chapter 42: Where Jesus' words, "In my Father's house are many mansions," become a reality as mankind consists of beings from many different steps in evolution, and the beings from these steps differ from one another with regard to knowledge, talents, and attitude to life. Their dreams or dream existences are correspondingly different. The spiritual world can be divided into corresponding spheres or areas of experience. These areas therefore constitute a scale of steps of life experience that extends from the sphere of the savage to the area of the perfect human being in God's image. Each step has its particular wavelengths by means of which the manifestations of the beings from the step concerned are triggered. Since the greatest form of expression on these steps is the being's ideal or dream existences, these existences being in turn the being's experience of paradise, there are thus various kinds of paradise. The beings from the various steps each attain their particular paradise in accordance with their mental state and perception of life. Jesus' words, "In my Father's house are many mansions," thus here become established as fact for the advanced researcher. Chapter 43 The Christian World Religion's Ecclesiastical Teaching About Paradise and Hell. In accordance with this divine principle, that spiritual matter automatically takes form in accordance with thoughts, wishes and the will, the preaching of the world religions has really had a great and decisive influence on the being's experience of the state of paradise after death. Within the Christian world religion one knows nothing of reincarnation. Here one has therefore absolutely no logical, just basis for the structure of life itself. When beings do not acknowledge or understand that their present fate is a result of the behavior they have manifested in previous lives, just as their behavior in their present life will contribute to forming the basis for the fate that they will receive in future, new terrestrial lives or existences, one cannot possibly provide any just basis for all the sufferings and difficulties or the many unhappy fates that have tortured people for thousands of years. One has then simply created for oneself the notion that one will either go to an eternal hell after death, where one will have to burn in a perpetual fire without ever being able to escape this terrible suffering, or one must go to a paradise where one will be placed before God's throne and here see the Godhead, Christ and the Holy Spirit. Here one will then experience paradise along with others, and take part in paying homage to or praising this triune Godhead. And this state was thus to be the highest salvation or experience of life. Chapter 44 A judicial practice that is the culmination of injustice, and a Godhead who dictates to people a rule of conduct that he himself does not practice. But this previously mentioned ecclesiastical Christian view of life is simply a product of great ignorance, an ignorance that is still very conspicuous. That this view of life is illogical and thereby unloving is emphasized by ecclesiastical Christianity's own dogmas. It says that an almighty, all-wise and all-loving God exists behind the whole universe or cosmos. It also goes on to say that human beings, as well as all other living beings, are created by this God. It then says that human beings, insofar as they are unable to love their neighbor as themselves, are sinful. And they thereby incur the previously mentioned appalling torment in the inextinguishable fire of eternal hell. The crucifixion of Jesus did, however, give them the opportunity to avoid this torment, for his terrible agony and death were perceived as a punishment for all the sins of the world, which he had taken upon himself. The real sinners were thereby then admitted to the eternal paradise if they repented this sinful life that they had lived here on earth. Thus we arrive at a judicial practice that is a glaring culmination of injustice, and a Godhead who does not comply with the law of love, this compliance being something that he, as already mentioned, is professed to have dictated to people as a condition for avoiding the punishment of hell and entering paradise. How can it be just or loving to let thieves, robbers, murderers and other forms of sinners or so-called criminals avoid punishment through an innocent being taking this punishment upon himself and allowing himself to be tortured to death for this? Why does this Godhead thus demand the crucifixion of this innocent being in order to be able to forgive the criminals? Why can he not forgive them without this innocent being suffering? The Godhead will thus not relinquish his right to punish, but is totally indifferent to the recipient of this punishment, as long as it is carried out. What kind of love is this that the Godhead practices here in relation to the being that he allows to be crucified for the sins of others? It cannot be the kind whose purpose is to love one's neighbor as oneself. Can a loving God dictate to beings a rule of conduct that he himself does not practice? Chapter 45: A derailed perception of God. The situation becomes even more unloving when it is preached that living beings, and thereby also human beings, are created by God. But when people are created by God, they cannot be different from how He created them. If people are not perfect but are sinners, the mistake must have been made by the Godhead who created them. The responsibility rests not with the creation but with the Creator. If what He creates is not perfect, how can there be any justice in God punishing the beings for not being perfect, when this is thus entirely His own doing? Ecclesiastical Christianity goes on to preach that only a very small group of people enter paradise, while the remaining majority of people end up in hell. When the majority of these people created by the Godhead end up in hell, it must be in accordance with the Godhead's wish to see people tortured in the eternal torment and anguish of this hell. Why should He otherwise create the majority for eternal torment and suffering, and only a small group for paradise? But being able to feel pleasure in seeing other beings being tortured by suffering and anguish is, as will be remembered, a mental derailment we know under the concept of sadism. When the Godhead is said to be all-wise, almighty and all-loving, He must know in advance which beings will go to hell. If He does not know this, He is not all-wise. But if He knows this and does not want to prevent the beings from ending up in such an unfortunate state, which eternal hell must be, He is not all-loving. And if He is not able to save the beings from this hell, He is not almighty. Is it not obvious here that we are dealing with a derailed perception of the Godhead? It is not so surprising that such a perception of the Godhead, such an unreal world picture, cannot deliver people from war, sufferings and the fear of death. Chapter 46: The downfall of a derailed image of the Godhead and the birth of a new world epoch in which there is neither sin, punishment nor fear of death. Here it is obvious why a human being or a Christ had to be born with a stature that was so loving that the above mentioned image of God had to pale in comparison and ultimately crumble completely. What is the behavior of this Godhead described above compared with a human being who was so loving that on the cross, in the middle of the most painful mutilations that can be inflicted on a living being, He could love His executioners, the source of His unhappy situation, and cry out to the whole world, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." It is not so surprising that the earth shook and the veil in the Holy of Holies in the temple tore, because here an established image of God crumbled and paled to death before a human being in flesh and blood who was overshadowed by love's radiant abundance, a human being of a stature so gigantic that He would turn the whole of mankind's mental course towards the pinnacles of light, towards the absolutely only true and real Godhead, who constitutes the very culmination of infinite wisdom, universal love and omnipotence. And now, by virtue of the Comforter, the Holy Spirit, which is the same as the science of love or the science of God's consciousness and thereby of the solution to the mystery of life, mankind is in the process of being steered onto this course. In the revelation of this divine spirit or science, the Godhead, the universe and life will radiate and sparkle for mankind as an immaculate, loving panorama of life in which there are neither sinners nor punishment for sins, and where absolutely no one can come to live in eternal torment or hell, but where absolutely all living beings sparkle in God's halo as eternal immortal centers of life, and where love is the keynote of the universe and thereby the cosmos's eternal basis for life. Chapter 47: From a cosmic point of view, all living beings are well provided for and taken care of. As we have seen, no living being whatsoever is excluded from that which can be its paradise on the spiritual plane, except in those situations in which it is incarnated in the physical world. And this incarnation, as also previously mentioned, takes place only in order that the being can learn to follow God's thoughts and create with the same logical perfection as that represented by the Godhead's creation, the results of which are nothing but a joy and a blessing for living beings. It can be nothing but divine that the beings are allowed to leave their paradise to be born into the physical world, which is the world of evolution, experiments, mistakes and thereby disappointments and suffering, and do not need to contaminate their paradise or holy of holies with wood shavings or waste products from this transformation, which the sorrows and sufferings constitute. Whatever happens on the physical plane, all living beings, as we have seen, have a paradise that awaits them, a paradise that they can indeed normally enter quickly every time they are liberated from their decrepit or damaged physical organism in order to be able to reincarnate later in the physical world when the desire or longing for this world again becomes overwhelming. Imagine the divine love that overshadows all living beings, both animals and human beings. Imagine how, from a cosmic point of view, all living beings are well provided for and taken care of. But it is, after all, the consciousness of the Godhead in which we live and move and have our being. Chapter 48. When people have a dark experience of purgatory because of their religion, since paradise is a spiritual realization of the dreams that physical existence engenders in living beings, and is thus created in spiritual matter by their capacity for thinking, the kinds of thoughts that the dogmas and views of their religions bind them to inevitably have a greater or lesser influence on the paradise they will experience after their physical terrestrial life. The Christian faith, for example, based on the ecclesiastical doctrine that has been preached to its followers, has inevitably created in many souls a terror of death and the hell that awaits them after death, that is, awaits all those who are not baptized or who do not receive the forgiveness of sins by the blood of Jesus and the mercy of God. The faithful, conscientious followers of the above-mentioned ecclesiastical Christianity will inevitably feel guilt-stricken because they have not been able to love their neighbor as themselves, which is of course quite impossible for an unfinished human being. But when they feel guilt-stricken or think that they have sinned, they believe that eternal hell awaits them after death. And not all these people trust that the sacrament of Holy Communion nor their prayers for the forgiveness of sins can save them from the gruesome or satanic fate that it must be to be burnt in an eternal hellfire. Death is thus a horrific nightmare for such beings. Some will even experience the feeling of being burnt in the above-mentioned hell because the existence in purgatory is shaped precisely by the kinds of thoughts that dominate one's thinking. These believers thus receive, as seen here, an intensified experience of purgatory. Chapter 49. The beings in purgatory and the intervention of the guardian angels. It is fortunate for the distressed beings in purgatory that the greater their darkness or suffering, the more quickly their inbuilt, automatic organs for prayer are activated, and they cry for help. And through this cry or mental attitude they get onto the same wavelength as the guardian angels, who then give them a helping hand and lift them out of their dark thoughts. This happens mainly through the gradual deactivation of the part of the being's mental construction through which they experience their dark thoughts. After this they are freed from thoughts such as disappointment, depression, bitterness, anger, envy, jealousy and fear, and physical pain. Their consciousness has thereby been very much limited in size, but on the other hand they can then experience only joyful thoughts and nothing whatsoever that can destroy or defile them. Here too they can meet only beings of the same wavelength range. Here they can therefore experience only pure light and joy. Even beings that are deadly enemies on the physical plane can be nothing but friends here on the spiritual plane, since their set of senses can no longer register any dark or antipathetic ways of thinking. They can regain contact with these ways of thinking only when they are reborn on the physical plane, and this set of organs has been reactivated. Chapter 50: The Being's Religious Paradise and Other Dreams. All those people who believe in their religion's concept of paradise and for whom this has become their hope and dream existence after death will of course experience the realization of this. Christians will experience the realization of their concept of paradise.